This is the Actual Fluency Podcast, helping you become a better language learner by providing motivating weekly inspiration, as well as top tips and tricks from expert guests. And now, your host, Chris Broholm.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Actual Fluency Podcast. This is the seventh episode of the third season, and today I'm joined once again by Mr. Michael Levi Harris, and this is a part two of the last week's episode. So if you haven't listened to season three, episode six yet, I highly recommend you go listen to that first, as we introduce a lot of the things that we talk about in this episode. So, please go one episode back and listen, and then come back to this one. Michael Levi Harris is the star and writer of the Hyperglot movie. And during this interview, we talk a lot about the movie, being a language learner in general, being a hyperglot in general, and some of the challenges that Michael has with learning languages, which is no surprise shared by many people. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. And because I've had a few delays lately on the podcast. I try to bring one out every week when possible. And some weeks it's just not possible because of, sickness or traveling or, things happen. But in the last few weeks, there's just been minor delays. The episodes have gone out, but they've been up to like 3 or 4 days delayed. And that's not ideal. So to kind of compensate for that and bring back the schedule a little bit, I'm going to release two episodes right after each other. So if you're listening to this as it comes out on Saturday the 12th of December, you can look forward to a new episode of the Actual Fluency Podcast already tomorrow, Sunday the 13th of December. And this episode is going to be with the CEO of Memrise, Mr. Ed Cook. And we're going to talk about the new Membus project and Memrise in general, the future of online learning, spaced repetition-based learning. And you can still get involved in the Membus project, drive around the most epic multilingual road trip ever attempted. You can check out the Membus project on Google, and you'll find the Kickstarter where you can still contribute. But for now, here's the continuation of the interview with Michael Levi Harris.
I did feel a bit, if I could somehow have changed any part of my personality, it would have been maybe a lack of discipline and focus, because I think that, when people ask how many languages I speak, I always have difficulty with that, answering that question. I tend to just say 10. That's my number. Right. And then I'll list them, and then somebody will walk by who speaks a different language that I haven't just listed, and I'll converse really well with them. And the person I'm talking to says, wait a minute, you speak 11 languages. Yeah. And I think, well, my definition of speaking is different necessarily, from other people's. But I, even with those 10, I really feel like, given that I have a good ear for it and a good mind for it and an ability to keep it straight, which I never really thought of as an ability until I've met people who've told me that they can't keep different languages straight, that they learn a foreign language and then they try to learn another one, but the other foreign language keeps coming out. Yeah. So I get, I have some ability with that. And I just, if I could only have kind of combined those abilities and an innate skill with discipline, I feel like the 10 languages that I speak, I could, speak at a spy level accuracy.
Right. Well, you can't be too hard on yourself,
life's not over. I can keep going.
10 is okay, as I've been studying mm-hmm. Meta studying, just realizing that learning a language is not difficult, but you need to persevere and you need to do persistent efforts. So I mean, that the problem of staying disciplined and focused, I think, is shared by pretty much everyone listening to this. So yeah, definitely don't feel
well,
too
and
bad
I
on yourself.
You know, I read an article about somebody who spoke a lot of languages, don't remember who, that kind of like characterized people that speak a lot of languages as people who do nothing else besides learn languages. Right. All the, that their life revolves around that. And I don't know if that's true of whoever that article was about or not. I don't want it to be true of my for myself. I mean, obviously I love acting and storytelling, and those things are really connected in my mind. It's all about communicating with people, and language is one way, you know, one facet of communication, but telling a story is a medium of communication. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't choose to speak those 10 languages perfectly, if there is such a thing, plus another 5 at the expense of, you know, the other things that I like to do in life.
Yeah, yeah.
But what, you know, it's just that I guess where I'm hard on myself is I don't know why I haven't, you know, taken 10 minutes a day to read something in each of the languages that I speak, just to keep it fresh, because I think that's really important. Because as you said, learning a language, I don't think is that hard. It, maintaining it and keeping it is what's hard. Because if you don't use it, you lose it.
Yeah.
And if you don't have people around you to speak with, the only other thing you can really do is read in it. So I, you know, that would still be time for me to act and, you know, cook, which is something I like, and do genealogy, which is a big hobby of mine, and still spend a few minutes a day. Right. And why I don't do it, I don't know. I mean, partially because there's always a different language that I want to be, one that I don't already know that I'm like interested in.
Yeah. I think that's the question. I mean, I'm asking myself the same question, and, you know, I don't even have 10 to worry about yet. So, I mean, I have the same problem just with a couple of languages. And for me, I think it's the idea that 10 minutes isn't really 10 minutes. It's like I almost need to mentally prepare for the 10 minutes. And then I need a little wind down period after the 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's not just like picking up a book and then starting a stopwatch. It's like, because when you read something, you get engaged to it. You know, you really become involved, unless it's really bad. But then again, why would you read it? So for me, I'm a lot more all or nothing. I would do like an hour or maybe 2 hours every week instead of those, you know, 10, 15 minutes every day. And I'm sure that's, again, shared by many people out there.
And I think maybe what's frustrating, actually, is that on second thought, reading is better than nothing, but it's actually not always what will help you to maintain a language. I think like I should be reading more, for example, in Arabic and Persian, because I find that I'm forgetting vocabulary words. Mm-hmm. And reading is a good way of keeping up vocabulary words. And I find that I pick up a newspaper in Arabic and I come across a word that I know that I knew once and have now forgotten. And that's a problem that can be solved by reading. But on the other hand, reading doesn't help, I think, with keeping up a level of speaking, because, and maybe that sounds obvious because they're two different skills, but what I notice is that I can read really well in most all of the languages I speak, and then some that I don't speak. You know, I don't really count Dutch as a language that I speak. I sort of say I can converse in, you know, on my acting CV, I categorize the languages into fluent, proficient, and conversant. Because for acting, you know, you usually don't have to improvise. There's a script. So if somebody gave me a script in Dutch, I could do it. No problem. So that's why it's on my resume anyway. But I can read Dutch. You know, in fact, I helped a friend with an audition for a short film a while ago. Like a week ago, actually, 2 weeks ago, and it was in Dutch, and all the stage direction, everything was in Dutch.
Oh, wow.
And she forwarded it to me so that I could be prepared, and I read it very easily. I mean, yeah, there was the odd word, I didn't know what it meant, but the whole gist of it I got.
Yeah.
So reading, I find, is a bit passive, you know, because I can do it and understand and get whatever it is out of it. And every time I've had to read something for some purpose, you know, whether it's Italian or French or just something that I don't use often enough, or Romanian, let's say, I mean, because my French is good, but, you know, something that is not on the forefront of my mind, but if I read it, I think, like, oh, I know what it's saying, which is similar to, I think, people that understand a language and can't speak it.
Right.
So it isn't enough, actually, to just spend 10 minutes a day reading, unless the issue is vocabulary, right. I think.
Yeah, but doing anything will help you in some capacity. I mean, maybe not speaking. There's also the big problem of,
if you're reading a newspaper, that vocabulary or lexicon is actually quite different from the spoken in Arabic. It's the biggest problem, I suppose, where you have in, if you have in modern standard Arabic and then you go out in the street and try and speak, and they're like,
yeah,
you know, they understand you, but they look at you like you're a newsreader or something. So yeah, I guess the question is out there, you know, how can we get those short bursts of learning in every day to maintain and also improve? You know, if you have weak languages, doing those 10 minutes of listening or watching or reading, it just seems so hard. For me, it's much easier for me to just cut off an hour and say, okay, I'll do an hour of flashcards or something, than it is to do 10 minutes of reading.
Well, that's, I mean, that's something that I like about smartphones, which I don't know, part of me hates smartphones, but I do like the fact that now you can do things like have flashcards on them, or games, language game things, and or listen to music, or, you know, you can just do things on them while you would otherwise not be doing anything. And I've read a lot about how sometimes it's useful not to do anything and to just sit with your thoughts, and I try to do that too. But sometimes, you know, in modern day life, there's a lot of kind of sitting, and I don't know that I need all of the sitting around and waiting that I do to be with my own thoughts. Right. So I find that I make use of that time in terms of refreshing and learning. At the moment, I'm doing Pimsleur Mandarin because I'm going to China in April with my school to perform. And I did Pimsleur Mandarin years ago and never used it after, so pretty much forgot it all. So it's sort of a redo for me.
Well, that would be
which
helpful.
Is also helpful, actually. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, it's helpful to redo things. And I think something that I've learned along the way is that my nature is kind of like a purist nature. I like to have one method that works for me and just do things one way and do it thoroughly. And I've learned that does work for me to start with. You know, I think it can be confusing to do too many different language programs or look at too many different books at the same time when you're starting, because each one of those is designed with in a different way pedagogically. And some books it's hard to find good ones, actually, because I find a lot of really flawed ones. But I love starting a language learning thing with Pimsleur because I know where I'm going, and because I had success with it before with Portuguese. And then after a point, you kind of want more, and you want to, you know, if you are somebody that already knows several languages or knows a lot about grammar, at a point it becomes more useful for you to just look at a verb chart and, okay, this is how you conjugate a verb, rather than wait until their method, you know, has gotten through all of the personal pronouns. But what I especially like about it is the way it's the focus on pronunciation. Yeah. And I absolutely think that people should learn to speak before they read or write.
Right, yeah.
Unless you know that you're really good with sort of phonetics and being able to look at a letter and know that that letter might have a completely different quality in a different language. But most people that I've ever met, and I'm not really talking about polyglots, I guess, or language enthusiasts, I should say, just people in general, are not that pernickety about phonetics. And so they see an R and they just think of an R in their own language. Yeah. Whereas if they were just listening and repeating what they heard, they would be so much more accurate.
Right.
And I do this now with something that I do on the side. I help other actors do different accents for roles that they have.
Right.
So I've helped people to speak in a Portuguese accent or a German accent or an English accent. And what I realize is that it's easier for them to imitate the sounds if they don't know what, by using made up words, so that they don't have an idea of what word they're saying, and they're just imitating the sound. And funny enough, that if I haven't done it my job quite right, once I give them a word, they get it wrong because they automatically are thinking of that word and how they normally say it or how it's spelled.
Yeah.
So I'm a big proponent of, and that's why I like Pimsleur, because you do it without writing first and you just listen.
And they really, really drag the pronunciation out in the beginning. They really focus on breaking down each word and really, you know, repeating it many times. And actually, for me, it was a bit too slow sometimes in the beginning. But I recently interviewed Idel Zanes, who has like a pronunciation course online called The Mimic Method. And that was in, I can't remember which episode, but it was in season 3 at least. And, you know, I really realized that I hadn't been focusing enough on pronunciation, because I went into it thinking, well, a good enough pronunciation is probably fine. But actually, coming to realize that pronunciation does not only help you to make yourself understood, it actually also helps you to understand others. And that's when I realized that, you know, you should really focus on pronunciation first and get that right, so you don't develop those bad habits of, you know, going into Russian and just people don't understand what you're saying. You know, it's better to use that time up front and then have a great accent down the road. So I definitely agree with you. And I also agree with you that it's not, it's very underrated. People like to think of the good enough method. And I think that applies to other areas. Like, you know, you can speak good enough. You don't have to be perfect or anything. But with pronunciation, I think working extra on it is definitely worth it. So happy to hear you made the same observation.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a big crossover with acting, I think, is that, you know, you could deliver a monologue or even a line with all the real feeling and sentiment and emotion and intention in the world. And if they didn't understand what you said because your diction was poor or because you didn't project enough, then all of that hard work has gone for nothing.
Right.
That's like the first thing. It's not the only thing, but it's the first thing that you have to do, I think, is be understood. And even in terms of practicing, if people, you know, if the best, surely the best way to keep a language up is to practice it with somebody. And I just think even for people to be able to practice with you and to take you seriously, if you're speaking, you know, if it's really hard to understand you, then I think that there's just something that automatically shuts off and people will disengage from talking to you because either they're finding it difficult or subconsciously they're thinking you don't really speak it that well because your pronunciation's, you know, is not good.
You do run into the other problem that we mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Which is funny because it happened to me. I live in Hungary now. Mm-hmm. And it happens to me all the time because I know how to greet people. I know how to order. And I'm sure they know I'm not Hungarian, but they probably assume I'm much better than I am.
Yeah.
And I say something like, I'll have a coffee. And they say, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can sort of guess what they're saying, but I can't just say yes or no because I don't know which way they phrase the question.
Yeah.
And it was like, my friend told me, oh, she's probably just asking if you want to go or to stay.
Yeah.
But I mean, you have no idea. And then you kind of have to like give up and go with the, sorry, I don't speak Hungarian anyway. So that's kind of funny. I don't know if there's a solution to that. I guess you just need enough exposure to the follow-up questions. And
well, I feel like I've mastered the art of kind of constructing my accent so that it sounds like I speak well enough, but I don't necessarily try my best.
Right.
So that people
slow down.
Yeah. So that they'll recognize that I'm a foreigner and that I'm not, you know, as good as my accent might have them believe. Whereas if I were, you know, acting in a foreign language, let's say, I would be doing my damnedest to sound exactly right, because there's no need to worry about what the person's going to say.
Is that a very valuable skill for actors these days, to have a lot of languages on their CVs? Are there good opportunities?
You know, they always say that, but because not just languages, but accents, but because of, you know, the world is so globalized and because so many people want to be actors, and because film has become increasingly about realism and being realistic, they, you know, if they want somebody from the north of England, they will find an actor from the north of England. Oh, right. They won't ask you to do an accent. Where accents come in get in handy well is in a smaller production, or not necessarily smaller actually, but it's more, this is more common in smaller productions or regional productions, but where a character is playing more than one role, an actor is playing more than one role.
All right.
So sometimes, and that, you know, occurs every so often, and sometimes one of the roles either requires a different accent, or the actor and director decide that it should have a different accent to help differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very useful. As for languages, I don't know. I mean, my dream is to be remembered at the end of a hopefully very long life as you know, an international actor that, right, that acted in so many different film industries around the world. I want to be in a French movie, in an Italian movie, in a Brazilian,
right,
telenovela, and I mean, that's my ideal career, is to just to do all of that, and not just once, but, right, you know, to be every time they want a quirky American character in a French film, like, oh, we're gonna call Michael Levi Harris,
right?
That's what I want.
Yeah. No singing though. Or do you do that as well?
No, I can sing.
Do you want to get it? You could do all the, like, the localized Broadway shows, and, you know, all around the world they do local productions.
Well, I think they usually do them in English, though, don't
no,
they?
No, no, do not at all. No, languages? They have their own languages.
Oh.
Germany is very popular for doing their own
language. Well, with stuff like that, I'm sure they would hire local actors.
Well, you say that, and then you see something like, I saw there's a big show here in London running for like 11 years called Wicked,
mm-hmm,
and they use the Dutch star in Germany, because, oh, yeah, obviously you learn impeccable German in the Netherlands, so she just kind of went over and just did it in German, and the coolest part, I suppose, was that after doing it in the Netherlands in Dutch and then German in Germany, she went to Broadway and did it in English. So,
oh, really?
That's a pretty cool language story there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would love a career like that. I think that, generally speaking, people don't expect, you know, actors to be multilingual and necessarily acting in different languages. But that, again, I mean, that's also where I'm hoping my niche will be. Hoping to be... I certainly wouldn't be the first. I mean, there are actors that have acted in more than one language, sure, but I'm talking like really recognizably doing several different. Yeah, you know.
Well, it's definitely also about, I mean, the scripts need to be written to sort of accommodate this thing, and I think that's somewhat new. I mean, you don't see many movies that are quite multilingual, or they do it in that stupid way where, oh, we're in France, so we're speaking English for some reason. It's like, What are they doing, you know?
Yeah.
It would be nice to see some pure multilingual movies, but I don't know. Maybe it's too niche for the Hollywood audiences of the world.
Yeah, I don't know that you'll get a Hollywood multilingual movie. I think it'll be more likely to come from other countries. You get a lot of, you know, historical dramas in that have lots of different languages, right, in them, but usually not where the character is speaking a different language. I mean, in Inglourious Basterds, Christoph Waltz, that was so notable because he spoke, I think, four different languages very well, mm-hmm, and it was unusual, and it was a big deal, and I think I remember either reading or being told that Quentin Tarantino wasn't going to make the movie if he didn't find the right person who could do that. And of course I just thought, couldn't you just wait a few more years and I could have done it.
You were there. Yeah.
I would love to do that. And
well, you can make it happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why, I mean, that going back to the Hyperglot, that was why ultimately at the end of the day, I made that film, because confronted with this possibility that I could do it on $300 and in 5 minutes, which of course neither of those things turned out to be even remotely accurate. But the point was, you know, to take control of my own career, yeah, and rather than sit around and wait for somebody to cast me in something, you know, because casting is such a difficult process whereby you could be the greatest actor in the world and you could, you know, be exactly what somebody likes, but if the person who's ultimately in charge really wants someone who's 2 inches taller than you, then you just don't cut it. Or, you know, so there's so many variables that something has to be exactly right for just you.
Right.
And, you know, the number of times that that comes along is so rare that you must have a better shot at writing something that is exactly for you. And without wishing to sound arrogant, I don't know that there's anyone else that could have played Jake in the Hyperclot. At least it would have been different, I think.
That would have been a very interesting sort of exercise to cast someone to play yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be... You'd really have to go outside and look at yourself. Yeah, an interesting experiment.
But I think that the way forward, you know, because lots of people asked me about will I make another one? Will I make a sequel? Will I turn it into a full-length movie? Because a lot of times people, you know, short films get turned into feature-length films. And my plan is that when I finish acting school this year, at the end of this academic year, so in summer of 2016, my plan is to... I hope that I'll get loads of job offers and things, and that would be great, but either way, I won't... The lesson that I learned from making the Hyperglot is that if you really put your mind to it, you can, you know, you can make your own success happen. And so I won't sit around, you know, for another 4 years before I decide to take matters into my own hands. I will work on something. I don't know how it will work, because I have too many ideas, and I don't know if I want, you know, part of me is afraid to, if I use all of them, then I've put all of my ideas into one thing, and, you know, what if I want to do another one, or what if that one is a failure? And, you know, so you don't want to use all of them, but then you're not sure what do you use and what don't you use. And what's funny is that the languages is the kind of connecting factor in all of them, because it's such a part of me, and anything that I would write about, I heard this great quote the other day, which is something I sort of knew inherently or had learned at some point, but not said, I didn't know how to express it as succinctly as this, which is, you should only ever write something that only you could write.
Right.
And I think that's a fantastic piece of writing advice. And I well, maybe other people could have written something similar to the Hyperglot, but it would have been different. They wouldn't have written that exact movie, because those stories happened to me.
Exactly.
And where was I going with that?
It could be a franchise, you know. You could have the Hyperglot, like the series.
Yeah,
it could be a series.
It could be a lot of things. Oh, I know what I was saying. So that anything else that I write, I mean, language is such a intrinsic part of who I am, that every somehow there's always something language related that, you know, will creep in, and I don't necessarily want to use the same character in completely unrelated films all the time.
Right.
And, you know, so for example, I as I mentioned earlier, I have a hobby that I really enjoy is genealogy, and I'm really into it. And I have loads of ideas about writing something with that. A big part of genealogy, especially in my case, is being able to look at records in Russian and Polish and Yiddish and know what they say. And then I've had lots of traveling experiences visiting places where my great-grandparents came from.
Wow.
And I have loads of stories that could go into a Hyperglot film from that. But so then the question is, do I make a Hyperglot film that's about that and you know, talking about that's intertwined with genealogy, or should genealogy just be its own subject, which it could be. And other, you know, so I have lots of kind of ideas like that about other spheres of my life where, yeah, but the character kind of has to speak a couple of languages, just a couple of languages. Right. For, he doesn't have to be a hyperglot, but he has to be a polyglot because of that. And I mean, I don't know, maybe that could be a thing. Maybe I have it wrong. Maybe instead of wanting to be remembered as the actor that acts in loads of different film industries, maybe I just, you know, become a writer actor who in every film, even though the characters are totally different and unrelated, happens to speak several languages. Well, I don't know.
You never know, but I think you got something right that if you, when you're done with school, you're sitting around and, you know, just get writing and see where it takes you. You can, I don't know how it works after you have your script, but I suppose you can send it to some people and they'll be like, this is terrible. This is decent.
Well, that will always be the case. I mean,
another story.
It took me 3 years to write The Hyperglot.
Wow.
Not 3 years of like concentrated, sure, every day sitting down, but just, you know, I would get really inspired and sit down and write, and then I'd do it for like a couple of weeks and then show it to somebody and they'd have all these terrible things to say about it and I'd sort of give up, and then a few months later I'd come back to it, and it was sort of that kind of thing. And I was constantly sending scripts to other people for their advice, people who I thought, you know, had more experience than I did with writing. And then just other people who were actors or who, you know, everybody will have an opinion. Everyone's opinion is valuable in some regard. But I was sort of really going in circles with it a lot. And at one point I just sort of thought to myself, you know what? Everyone is going to have an opinion. And at some point it's mine. And yeah, I just have to decide what I want it to be, which is what I eventually did. And I finally sat down and said, you know what? This is it. I'm happy with this. So this is what it's going to be. And, yeah, and then actually what's really nice is that because The Hyperglot's done well and been well received, it's managed to be seen by potential investors who could fund a future project. Right. And so that part of it won't actually be as difficult. And the director of The Hyperglot is tremendous. I mean, extremely talented person. And he wouldn't be shy. I mean, I don't think he would work on something that he didn't like. So Assuming I wrote a script that he liked, I think he would do it again in a heartbeat. Right. And if he didn't like it, he'd say why, and then maybe I would fix it or whatever. And so it wouldn't be nearly as difficult, the task of sort of getting into it, because I had a great experience with the cast and crew of The Hyperglot and the director, and I know where to get at least some of the funds from. I mean, there might be some more fundraising that needs to be done. Well, buy The Hyperglot on iTunes. That will help.
For sure. Yeah.
But yes, the hardest part of the next one will just be writing it.
Yeah, that's the thing. You don't get paid while writing, so you have to sort of mix up your time between actually working to sustain your life and then writing.
Yes.
So, I mean, if it took you 3 years to do that with a short film, yes, then it's probably going to take some more time. I don't know. Maybe there's some easier things about writing a long film. You have more sort of room. I don't know. Maybe that's just as far-fetched. But
no, I think, I just have no idea how it will be. But I wouldn't allow myself 3 years to do it. At some point, you just sort of have to make something. Otherwise, you know, to make a movie every 3 years is not gonna do much, I think. So I would be more strict with it. But a big difference is I have much more confidence now, because before it was just sort of this quirky idea, like, wouldn't it be funny if I wrote a movie of thing that you don't really think is gonna happen. And actually I would say that really what finally made it happen was after 4 years, 3 or 4 years of working in New York as an actor, and I got to the point where I thought, either, you know, something needs to change. You know, I need to be doing much bigger, better stuff, or I need to move on and do something else in life. in spite of what I said about setting goals and measuring success and that I was doing relatively well for an actor means you're doing something.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're getting paid for it or making a living out of it. So I thought to myself, okay, I've got this script. I've got a director who says he likes it and he would do it if I have the money. I had had an office job for 2.5 years through which I saved a lot of money, which is how I funded the Hyperglot. I funded it myself from my savings, and it's also how I funded my school, at least the part of it that I funded. I also had very generous scholarships. But I thought to myself, right, I think this is the moment where I'm going to do this movie, and it is either going to be a resounding success that launches my career and is like the next thing that I need, or it is going to be a kind of closure on this chapter of my life, which was fun and filled with adventure. And I will, you know, when I'm old and tell my kids that once upon a time I was an actor, I can show them, I can prove it to them. And, you know, so it was going to be that. It was either going to be like a nice ending to my little acting career or a nice beginning.
Yeah.
And that was what pushed me over the edge of like, just spend your savings and do it, because it's money worth, you know, well spent if you just to know that I did something, to have something to show for it.
Right.
And then of course I got into this really prestigious drama school, and I thought, well, that's a game changer. And when that happened, right when the Hyperglot was just finished and right before it started the festival circuit. I've been kind of in limbo in terms of my career because I've been in school, so I have no idea whether the Hyperglot is the launching pad or the bookend. But because of its success, I'm confident of at least being able to try another, you know, and maybe that's just how life will be. Maybe the whole way through life, you just think, well, the last project was all right, so I'll just do one more and see. And maybe that's what everybody kind of does in their life.
It sounds good to me. You know, one more episode, one more film, one more book. That sounds like the dream. I could literally talk to you forever, I think. There is such a thing as attention span.
Yeah.
Online, and it's not quite this long. So I just, on a quick note, I just wanted to ask you about... Because I'm obviously part of the Polyglot community and, you know, multilingual. So when we saw your movie, it felt like, this feels quite normal. This is quite everyday life. Maybe not as absurd as some of the jokes, obviously. But have you had any reactions from people who are not into languages at all? And how did they sort of see, because they must consider Jake quite, you know, almost like a... what's that movie with, you know, almost like a genius kind of thing?
Because
he's speaking all these languages and he's kind of the cool guy, you know, with some flaws, of course. Mm-hmm. But how did they see it in terms of that? Because obviously we have a different perspective altogether, because, oh, that's just normal. You know, you find a book in a language you don't know, of course you get the teach yourself or the colloquial or whatever. So what kind of reaction has it gotten from sort of the non... language learning side of things?
It's been really well received. I mean, people, I don't know that anybody would go out of their way to tell you, you know, I saw your movie and I really hated it.
Right.
So maybe there are people that haven't liked it and they just are, you know, tactful enough not to find me on Facebook and tell me. Yeah. But I people seem to really like it, who, even if they're not into languages. And in fact, I think for people that aren't into languages, it's that much more of a unique idea.
Right.
I think people that aren't in a language learning community or language learning minded, especially in America, or in a, I shouldn't just say America, especially in an Anglophone place. I think people just don't expect that. Mm-hmm. They don't expect that somebody speaks 10 languages right. with ease and just in everyday situations. And I think that they think of it as a really unique, cute idea. And people, what a lot of people have said is that it's really charming. Right. They find Jake charming, and they find the whole story charming.
But that one woman in the movie did not find it very charming. Which one? In the Japanese restaurant.
Right.
It was like, oh, what are you guys speaking? It sounds so exotic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're speaking Portuguese. Okay.
Well, yes, I think she didn't. She didn't find Jake charming. Right. Which,
she's maybe more interested in your Brazilian friend.
Yeah, which is part of life. I think that people. I don't think they relate to it in the ways that language enthusiasts relate to it, but I think they find other things that they can relate to in it. The difficulty, you know, I've heard it described in different ways. You know, somebody somewhere described it as, you know, the search for love in a multi-language, multi-ethnic place like New York or something like that. You know, so some people I think just related to the difficulty of meeting somebody. Right. It was shown at a disabilities film festival, which is organized by the Jewish Community Center of the Upper West Side in New York. And the sort of headlining synopsis was, I don't remember the whole thing, but whatever it was, the story of a nice Jewish boy who blah, 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 which is, you know, for European listeners, the term a nice Jewish boy, I don't know how familiar that term is, but that's just a thing that, you know, New York Jews and maybe American Jews in general kind of an epithet they use to describe the kind of the boy next door,
right,
who happens to be Jewish and therefore they want to fix up with their daughter kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So now I don't know where they got that from, because yes, Jake has one line in Yiddish in the film, but there is no he has no religion. And while I may be a nice Jewish boy, I think from that perspective, it was like the people watching it, they looked at me and they looked at my perhaps Jewish looking face and just saw a nice Jewish boy in New York. And that was, you know, what it was to them. So people have picked up on different things. But mostly I think people like a story that is different. And the story of somebody speaking lots of languages has not been done before.
No.
And I feel like I'm sounding so arrogant in this podcast, because normally I'm very self-critical and
we haven't actually talked about what things you don't like, so maybe you want to
about the film. Yeah, or in life.
Or in life. So I don't like bananas. No, it's sort of more in the film. What would you have changed? I guess that's a really good interviewer question I should have asked about half an hour ago. So what would you have made different today if you had to do the movie again?
That's easy to say.
Under similar conditions, mind you.
Yeah.
You don't get £10,000 more.
No, it's quite easy. Because I wouldn't change much, because I was very happy with how it turned out. But in the scene where I am learning Maltese in the mirror, in the script I had just written a sort of a stage direction, you know, we see Jake repeating Maltese phrases to himself or something.
Right.
And because I was the executive producer and the writer, and executive producer effectively means that I had the ultimate say over everything. So
right,
whenever there was the smallest problem or the biggest thing, or what, it was always, you know, this production assistant or that production person asking me, yes, no, what do we do? And when we lost a location here and I had to find one. Things had to be rewritten. The day before filming that, I was up till 4 a.m. rewriting a different scene. And so there were so many different things that I was doing, and I was being pulled in so many different directions that I had neglected to actually look up and decide what Maltese things I would be saying in this.
Right.
And we suddenly, you know, we had done a bunch of filming, and then it was like, okay, now we're going to film the sequence where Jake is learning Maltese. And I hadn't decided what I was going to say, and didn't, and only had this sort of Yes, I can say inadequate Maltese book because the book that you see in the film is fake. It's a fake cover.
Right.
But it was around a real book that I bought when I went to Malta. And it was sort of inadequate in terms of for this purpose. And I just panicked so I did the best that I could with, you know, random, but I didn't, I would have made that smoother, and I would have made more sure of my pronunciation. Right. And then I was told that, at one point I was told I had made too many assumptions about the Maltese language in terms of how it's structurally similar to Arabic. And so when I sort of ad-lib talking to my, yes, oh, I don't want to give it away, but I ad-lib something in Maltese and in the scene in the park right before I meet the deaf girl. And it's incorrect Maltese, to make All right. a long story short. Which is fine, because the character is just learning it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I was like, all right, it's not the end of the world. But I did think, I sort of made that up based on a grammatical structural assumption that was wrong in terms of how you do the possessive in Maltese.
I guess it could have been cool if you knowingly made mistakes and you put the mistakes in the English as well, so everyone who didn't speak Maltese could see, oh, he's learning, so he's stumbling a bit through the sentences. That would have been a nice save.
Yeah. I think there was a version where I may have thought of that, and then we decided not to or something. And similarly, I would have also, I would have maybe, if I could have spent more time working on the Icelandic dialogue, because, well, the truth of the matter is, I think that the take that they used on that particular bit where I speak Icelandic was the first take.
Oh, really?
And this is a problem that, you know, I wasn't really prepared for in filming, but, you know, you do a bunch of takes, and then the editor, sometimes with the director, sometimes without, decides which is the best mm-hmm. one. Now, the editor and director did need to consult me on various, you know, to come into the editing room to make sure, A, of what I was saying and where it, what, you know, and that it was all correct and things like that. However, the quality of the language speaking was their last priority, because yeah. they were more concerned with things like the lighting and continuity. You know, if the glass was full 1 second, it can't be empty the next, kind of thing. And rightfully so, but therefore, you know, because for them and for, I think, the audience that they thought would receive this, which is just the average person and wherever, is not going to care or know how well I'm speaking these right. languages. Maybe that's not giving people enough credit, but maybe they would assume that I'm speaking it well enough, or they could tell I'm speaking it well enough that they don't question beyond that.
Right.
So for them, that was the last thing. For me, of course, it was, I wanted Jake to be better than Michael. Right. I wanted each of his languages to be absolutely perfect. And so with the Icelandic, I'm pretty sure it was the first take that we used. And we did a few takes, and after getting into it, I was much better. Whereas in that take, and I sort of hesitate to say it because I don't want to ruin the movie for people, but I sort of slightly over articulate, you know, so that I sound like I'm pronouncing every letter, in an effort to say it correctly. And it doesn't quite sound to an Icelandic person. So an Icelandic person told me it doesn't sound like smooth, connected right. speech. And that's a regret. I know, which is not entirely my fault. I, you know, because as I said, when that's, you know, I think we got there at like 4 a.m. for that scene to start with the hair and makeup and the set, and you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, action. And you know, you don't really get to practice,
right.
Except by doing a few takes. And I sort of was under the impression that, oh, I'm sure they always use the latter takes anyway, because the first few aren't good. But that's often not the case. And then, you know, similar things in other, not quite as bad as the Icelandic, but there were other bits of, in different languages where for me, for, my input in the editing room was this take is best because the language is the best in that one. And that got overruled because of the lighting was better in the other one or whatever.
Right.
So the what I could have done better or what I would do differently is just be better quicker at all of them, you know, have practiced more so that I could do it more easily. And I guess I should mention here, cause, and you asked about differences between Jake and Michael, is that I don't... So I think about half the languages in the film I do speak, and half of them I don't. So the ones that I do speak, were obviously much easier for me to get into, but Icelandic is not a language that I speak.
Right.
So that was...
But why did you decide to add them then, if you had your catalog of 10 to 15 languages you could choose from?
Because I wanted Jake to seem... Well, I mean, this is kind of funny, I suppose, saying this out loud. I wanted him to seem quirkier by speaking like more unusual languages, like Icelandic.
Right,
you know, what Anglophone person speaks Icelandic as a second language? And the reason why I think that sounds funny saying it out loud is because I'm sure to most the average viewer, the fact of speaking 10 languages is pretty quirky. but to me, I thought that it was almost too normal if he just spoke French, Spanish, Italian, German, you know, languages
the
that
usual.
People speak. So I wanted him to speak Icelandic and Norwegian and Japanese and British Sign Language. And
that was my favorite part, I think. British Sign Language part. I'm very fascinated with sign language. I cannot find a single practical use for it for me, unfortunately, living in, you know, around the world, and it's not standardized.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that was a great scene where you also the change, just hilarious. Everyone just erupted in laughter for that. So
yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah, well, I have to say that one. That was a good one for a language enthusiast audience, because I think people appreciated the quirk of changing from American Sign Language to British language, whereas I think, you know, most people don't realize that there's a difference.
Right.
And I think a lot of people might watch it and not necessarily be clear what ASL and BSL stand for until... I mean, I think people get it eventually, but... But yes, I recall... being told that got big laughs at the... I unfortunately wasn't able to be present at either time that it was viewed to a screen to an audience of polyglots, but I was told that always got a big a big laugh. Whereas in among other audiences, it didn't... It always took a bit... It always took, I think, time to register, and by the time it registered, it was one of those like, oh, that's clever, but it was too late to laugh, kind of.
Right. Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your experiences and this great movie with me and the listeners out there.
Thank you very much. I hope I haven't spoiled it for anyone that hasn't seen it. I hope you...
There's at least 2 minutes of footage that you haven't talked about. So
yeah. Yes, the plot twist.
No, I think the people listening to this would watch it even if you told the entire script verbatim. They would still watch it because it's just, you know, that's their life.
No, that's true. And people, I mean, have told me have watched it multiple times and enjoyed it every time. But I've been very obsessive about guarding that one bit just because I feel like it's sort of like, you know, when you watch a great movie for the first time. I mean, I'm not calling my movie a great movie. What I mean is that you watch a great movie for the first time. It's really special the first time you see it, and you may enjoy it every time you watch it after that, but there's nothing quite as special as before you knew what happened.
Right.
So in this movie, what I think is holds a lot of appeal is this
plot twist
that is just that much better if you don't see it coming.
Right.
I think so.
Yeah, well, I think you've done a good job. We certainly haven't spoiled anything today. I don't know about any other articles but thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Actual Fluency Podcast.